Hi, Gus Warland here, and welcome to Not an Overnight Success, brought to you by Shaw & Partners Financial Services. In this podcast, we sit down with some very successful people from the world of business, entertainment, and sport to chat about their life's journey and how they became the success that they are today. In today's episode, we are chatting to the legend, Lane Beachley. Lane's dedication to success made her the only surfer, male or female, to claim 6 consecutive world titles and the only woman to have 7 in total. She's the officer of the Order of Australia, chair of Surfing Australia, and founder of the Awake Academy. In this chat, Lane speaks openly about some experiences she faced as a child, like being conceived through assault and later adopted. That shaped her into the fierce competitor that we came to know and love. Lane is a powerhouse and the definition of what it means to be determined and driven. She is vivacious and cheeky. She shares a passion for mental fitness. And a big takeaway from this chat are the lessons that Lane has learnt about where we focus our own time and energy. And of course, this episode wouldn't be complete without talking about Lane's marriage to INXS member Kurt Pengilly. Without mentioning any spoilers, I'll tell you that it wasn't exactly love at first sight. As for all of these podcasts, Shaw & Partners have generously donated $10,000 to the charity of the choice of each of our guests. We discussed where that money goes in this chat. The executive producer of this podcast is Keisha Pettit, and we couldn't have done it without our great mate, Kelly Stubbs. Let's get into our chat with Lane Beachley. What were you like as a kid?
I was a shit kid.
What do you mean by that?
Well, look, I was anti-establishment, anti-rules. I grew up in the 70s, so I had the freedom of no mobile phones, no social media, come home when the streetlights come on, the freedom to play, the freedom to fail, the freedom to explore, discover, the freedom to maintain a sense of independence. Freedom is a massive value of mine. It's probably my overarching value. So as a kid, look, I was respectful, but I was very, as you can imagine, very competitive, quite tenacious, very determined, and very cheeky. Just love to have fun.
A bit like yourself now.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, you're just a bigger version of it.
Well, yeah, show me the woman, I'll show you the child.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. What were you like as a kid?
Put me in a box and let me...
What, like a pussycat?
Well, I was like, if you just give me my boundaries, I'll stay within them, to be honest with you. So my dad had left the family home. I was very young. I sort of felt like I had to do the right thing because mum had a lot on her plate.
Right.
And my brother was a little bit more left of centre. So I was sort of the good kid.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. The golden child.
A little bit.
The chosen one. It's funny how, you know, the stories that we tell ourselves when something traumatic happens, like a parent, you know, losing a parent, what role you now have to play in the family home. So how old were you when your dad walked out?
It was, now I look at it, it was officially around about 9.
Oh.
But dad was very much an absent parent from about 2 or 3 because he was travelling. So he was in a big job and, you know, dad's going away overseas. So he'd be gone for 3 or 4 months back in the day. They didn't back and forth back then.
Yeah.
It was a big thing getting on a 747 and flying to the other part of the world. So, you know, our relationship is much better now, but, you know, it was a long time there where I just really just missed him.
Yeah.
Just missed having that male person.
Yeah.
What was it like in your family? What was your makeup?
Well, my dad, similar to your dad, travelled a lot and worked really hard to provide for the family because back then that's what happened. You know? Mm. The dad went to work, the wife stayed at home and cared for the children and sent them off to school. My older brother, Jason, he's 5 years older. And then my mother, Valerie, she died when I was 6. So the dynamic obviously changed dramatically. But I was always a tomboy. I was always playing with the boys and being one of the boys. So I was very fortunate that at that age I didn't have that true understanding of the concept of forever, the understanding of losing someone so significant as impactful as my mother. And I wasn't a real mummy's girl anyway. So I apologise if you can hear all that banging in the background. Of course, the one day that you come over to do an interview, someone's deciding to do some renovations on their house just down the street.
Absolutely fine.
Okay.
You've been quite open about sort of your family setup and how it all started for you. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I was adopted into the Beachley family. I always say I was adopted into a beach-loving family, last name Beachley, become a pro surfer. Ta-da!
Yeah.
So good. Yeah. Very fortunate twist of fate, but if only it was also easy and, you know, rainbows and unicorns, which we all know it isn't. And the common theme amongst adoptees is this fear of rejection, this sense of worthlessness, this abandonment mentality. You know, we've been abandoned and rejected versus being accepted into another family. And I was very fortunate that I was adopted into such a loving family. You know, when Valerie gave birth to Jason, she had some severe complications, wasn't able to have more children. They decided they did want another one. So they applied for an adoption, and within 10 months I was delivered to their doorstep. So, well, in a hospital, and they got to come pick me up. So very different to what it's like today, which is the system around adoption in Australia is completely broken and needs to be rectified and fixed very quickly. But you can have that discussion with Deborah Lee Furness.
Yeah.
But from my point of view, I was very grateful that the mother who did give birth to me, my biological mother, Maggie, you know, I was conceived through date rape. She was forced to give me up before I'd even been born. And so from that emotional connection between mother and unborn child in the womb, I figured was broken from the start, you know. And so I felt deprived, and I'm only aware of this now. It's not something I knew of when I was in the womb.
No.
And it's not something I've become aware of in my, you know, teenage years or 20s. It's taken me to my mid-40s to realize that I was deprived of joy. I was deprived of love in the womb because I was not allowed to be kept. And there was moments where she wanted to keep me and she fought really hard for that, but she was 16 years of age, you know. There was no way that her parents were going to ever allow her to do that. I was 17 years of age. So in the end, yeah, I was adopted to the Beachleys and grew up with my older brother Jason and my dad Neil, and Val was there for a little while. And then, yeah, so Dad didn't choose to tell me I was adopted till I was 8. And that was that catalyst moment in my life when I just went, holy shit, everything that I thought about my life is now untrue.
Yeah.
Everything that I thought I belonged to, I no longer belong to. And the thing is, I did still belong to it, you know. There was still the truth of the family unit and the metaphysical connection. But in my mind, I decided, hang on, I no longer belong to this unit. I'm not from here. And because I've been rejected by the mother who gave birth to me, I decided that if I'm not worthy of her love, I'm not worthy of anyone's. So that's why I decided I had to become a world champion.
Why do you?
Isn't that what most people do?
Of course. I mean, I thought it. Didn't do it though.
You just became a world champion human.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So at the age of 8, why do you reckon he decided to tell you? What was the reasoning behind telling his daughter that I imagine was, you know, very well balanced and enjoying life and so forth? Why was 8 a moment?
Yeah, kids started talking about it, and you know how brutally honest kids can be. There was an obvious fact that was very different to the rest of my family.
What, to look at?
Yeah. Yeah, because they're all over 6 foot tall. They're kind of pasty white. They got brown hair, and I was 3 foot nothing, dark olive skin, bright blue eyes and bright blonde hair. And they're like, where do you come from?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But you didn't know that. You didn't see that.
No, I had this feeling. There was a sense of kind of – there was this restlessness. But it's not until people start questioning me did I start to question myself.
Yeah.
Up until that point, I never questioned it. But as you may know, that our brain waves shift when we hit 5 or 6 years of age. You know, we're in this narcissist state where everything's happening to us and how do we make sense of it? And then when we hit that 5 or 6-year-old state, our brain waves shift to a capacity to judge, criticize, and analyze. So being told I was adopted as an 8-year-old was probably the worst time you could possibly tell me, because now I can judge it and criticize it and analyze it and work out how I fit into that versus just absorbing knowledge and then digesting it the best that I can as a child. So it was traumatic. I felt like Alice in Wonderland and this tiny little girl in this rather large chair that just decided to swallow me whole. I really did want to fall into one of those little tunnels and just run away. But that's when, yeah, I just went, okay, I've got to become a world champion because now that's my vision. That's my vision of success. And the only way I'm going to be deserving of love is if I fulfill my vision of becoming a world champion surfer. And then I won a world title. I was like, no, this isn't enough yet. Let's just do this another 6 times in a row and we'll see if I'm enough now.
We'll get to the surfing in a minute because there's lots to talk about there. So as an 8-year-old, you go through that moment and you come out the other side, but you decide, I'm going to focus on being a champion surfer. Is that because you had been surfing since the age of
4?
Okay.
Yes.
And were you good?
Yeah, you just asked me. Well, you didn't have to, I'll tell you. Yes, being that independent tomboy who had a competitive spirit as a child, surfing was just a natural place for me to fall into. At the time, in the 70s and 80s, it was an unviable vocation for women. And I was strongly discouraged by my teachers, by my peers, by my male counterparts. But it was a place that I constantly daydreamed about, I constantly longed to be in. I was just so passionate about surfing, and I never saw it as the means to an end. I just saw it as a place where I felt like I truly belonged, and that's all I craved. That's all we all crave. That's what we're hardwired for, is to belong. And that belonging comes from a true sense of connection, and that's where I feel truly connected, is in the water, is in Mother Nature. And it's where I feel like I truly surrender. And once I had an awakening around that whole relationship with joy in the womb, is going back into the ocean for me is going back into the womb. It's where I feel that sense of safety and that sense of connection and warmth, and I just surrender to that. I can almost feel it now. It's like, oh, I'm free.
Your happy place.
It is my happy place, absolutely. So I'm very fortunate that I've always had that relationship with the ocean, and that was from being plonked in it before I could swim, before I could walk. You know, I fell in love with it then. So learning to surf as a four-year-old, then paddling out on my own as a five-year-old, surfing on my foamy in the southern corner at Manly Beach until I'm 13, and then progressing onto a fiberglass surfboard, and then that was basically the stepping stone to a professional career.
Do you think you would have, if you'd stayed with your birth mother, do you think you would have been a surfer?
No, I probably would have been a tennis player, because she lived in Surrey Hills.
Ah.
So I was pretty far from the ocean.
Yeah.
But I was always going to channel my competitive spirit into sport.
Yeah.
That's just, that was the one subject at school I really loved, PE.
Yeah.
When's PE?
Yeah.
Maths, English, science, geography. Yeah, I love it, but PE, let's play.
Yeah. Okay, so tennis might have missed someone, but surfing.
No, tennis doesn't miss me.
No.
Surfing doesn't miss me much either anymore, but I still surf every day. But no, tennis I loved, and I played it as I was competing in surfing, and I travelled the tour with a tennis racket and wiped a lot of my peers off the court.
Yeah.
They just hated me for all sorts of reasons. I competed in the water and on the...
Can you play just a game for fun?
Yes, I can now. It's taken me almost 50 years to work that out.
So at what age did you just have a game of tennis or had a surf and it was for fun and you went, I'm actually okay now, not being the best?
At 47.
Do you have to have that type of attitude to be a world champion, do you
think? Well, I definitely believed I had to. And here's the question that everyone asks. Do you think you had to have that level of drive or that level of ferocity or that win-at-all-cost mentality to achieve the success you achieved? And look, it fueled me and it served me and it gave me the impetus to do what I did. But I have now since proven that I didn't have to be that tenacious, compassionateless tiger shark that I was tagged as being. But at the time, I thought that's what it took to win. And because we all have a confirmation bias, we'll constantly seek proof of whatever we believe to anchor us in our proof and anchor us in our beliefs and then validate our beliefs and therefore validate our behaviours. So if you don't have that sense of consciousness or awareness about your own confirmation bias, and if you don't have the curiosity and the courage to then poke holes in all of the evidence that's validating your belief, then you will constantly be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm. And that's what I was throughout my professional surfing career for the five of the six consecutive world titles. Because I've won seven world titles. I won six of them consecutively, the only athlete in surfing to ever do that, male or female. But I've won five of them in a state of fear, and that was world titles 2-6. My career was bookended by love, and that was 1-7.
Can you tell us more about that?
About love versus fear?
Yeah.
So fear to me is win at all costs. Love is surrendering and trusting in the process. That's as simple as I can place it. For
That's beautifully said. And when I do talk to you, Lainey, we've been mates for over a decade now, and it's always been on a, you know, a basis where there's mutual love there, I think, from pretty much from the start.
Yeah.
But I've never heard you speak so eloquently about, you know, sort of the, I don't know, the feelings or the, you know, you're really, really in touch with yourself now. I'm tearing up thinking about you being the person you are.
Stop it. You'll make me cry.
Sorry. No, we shouldn't apologise for crying.
No, I love to cry. And, you know, I cried a lot as an athlete, especially when I lost because I placed so many unrealistic expectations on my own shoulders that when I came out of the water, if I haven't fulfilled those expectations, let alone exceeded them, I beat myself up relentlessly.
But you were a world champion.
No,
how big were you wanting to be? Like universe champion or?
I wanted to win every event I surfed in. I wanted to be the best role model. I wanted to be the best spokesperson. I wanted to be the best surfer. I wanted to be the best of the best of the best of the best.
The best has ever been.
The best has ever been. Look, I'm not. And I was never going to be. But because I had these unrealistic expectations on my own shoulders, when I came out of the water having not fulfilled those expectations, I was never going to be enough. I was never going to be satisfied. And because I felt like I'd not only let myself down, but I'd let my support crew and my team down, then I beat myself up to beat people to the punch. I didn't want them to beat me up. So you can't beat me up any more than I can beat myself up. So I'm going to show you how fucking hard I can be on myself. I'm going to prove to you how much you can beat yourself up. Here, watch me. So I used to bawl my eyes out. And my peers, they perceived that as being a sore loser, because they didn't understand me. And we judge what we don't understand.
Of course.
But we also become what we judge.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all connected through external validation. So if you have this belief that you're not enough, which is 99% of the population, well, it's 100% of the population except for the Dalai Lama at some stage or another, because he is one with everything.
He sure is.
But if you believe that you're not enough, it's at any point in time, then you're going to start seeking external validation to either validate that or challenge that. And when I was joining the pro tour, or even when I had the aspirations to become a world champion surfer and I was competing, you know, surfing with the guys down at Manly, I was constantly reassured of the fact that I'm never going to make it. I was constantly reassured that I'm not enough. But I didn't need their reassurance, because I already had this fundamental belief that I was not enough. And the way that I articulate it now, and I've turned it into my own model, it's like an oyster model, is that if you think about three circles that are joined at the bottom, the middle circle is your identity and how you identify yourself. The second circle outside of that that joins at the bottom of the identity circle is the stories that we tell ourselves to validate that identity. And the third circle outside of that are the events that trigger the stories, which then determine our identity. So I've had this identity since I was 8 years of age that says you're not enough. You're worthless, right? So I've had this worthlessness that's been driving me my whole life. And I can easily find stories and events that truly validate that piece. And I've been doing it my whole life. And then I started the Awake Academy, and I've been doing work with people to wake them up, which awakens me. That's why I love doing what I do. That's my own personal why. Awaken others awakens me. And it is agitating more than I've ever imagined, because it's totally blowing apart my worthlessness story. It's completely challenging my identity. And I'm so attached to that worthlessness identity because it served me so well.
Yeah.
It's kept me humble. It's kept me grounded. It's kept me driving for more, doing more, being more, serving more.
You couldn't be you without it.
Apparently not. But now I'm realizing I don't need that identity anymore. Mm. And actually, I can choose to be enough in this moment right here, right now, and we all can. Yet what part of ourselves, our intrinsic selves, is actually saying, nah, you can't.
Yeah.
Nah.
If you go away from that, everything's going to crumble.
Yeah.
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 I know a lot of really successful people.
Yeah.
And they all have that.
Yes.
In some, you know, that sort of someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and go,
yeah.
You know, come
yeah.
on.
Yeah. Wake up, son.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. on your way now.
Yeah, on your way now. And I'd be okay with that.
What responsibility did you feel for the fact now that women's surfing is like men's surfing, like it's like men's tennis and women's tennis? There's no difference now.
Mm.
How proud are you of that, and how much of a battle was it when you first started?
Have you seen a documentary called Girls Can't Surf?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So that gave you a snapshot of the battle. That was the absolute shit show that was women's surfing back in the 80s. We were in the 90s and 2000s. We were the sideshow. We were second-class citizens. We were not valued. We were devalued. We were disrespected. We were disrepresented, misrepresented. And it was a real challenge to earn the right to just even surf, let alone surf in quality waves. So it was a real battle. Fortunately, growing up in Manly fortified my resolve to fight that battle. And when I reflect back on that period, You know, when we go through really challenging times, we forget how bad and hard they were because we come out of them, we're like, oh, okay, I've survived that. And then we focus on how good we feel. We don't remember how bad we felt. It's like why women keep having babies, right?
Yeah.
It must be painful as hell. I can't imagine there's much joy in it.
In the end it is.
Of course. Yeah. Especially as a father.
Yeah, yeah.
You're the heroes. You walk in and out of the house and it's like, daddy's home.
Yeah, that's
Whereas the mum's home all the time being the disciplinarian and, oh, mum's here. So when I think about how women's surfing has evolved over the last 40 years, as far as my relationship with women's surfing, because I've been surfing for over 45 years now.
Don't look a day over 40.
Thank you, darling. Yes, you're so complimentary and such a liar. The love and reverence, acceptance, respect, admiration, gratitude, pride, just satisfaction, all of it, like I'm full of that. Because if all of the shit that I went through amounted to surfing, staying in the same place, I would have been bitterly disappointed. I mean, my vision when I joined the tour was to have it emulate women's tennis. I wanted women's surfing to stand on its own 2 feet. I wanted it to be where it is today. So knowing that I have played a little bit of a role in endorsing that and supporting that, and now seeing the likes of the Steph Gilmores, Tyler Wright, Sally Fitzgibbons, and also the future generation that are coming through the ranks like Isabella Nichols and Molly Picklums, and hosting my ID camps, like I have a talent ID camp up at Surfing Australia, hosting that and developing and nurturing and supporting the future generation. That's what it's all about.
Olympics, were you excited about that?
Very excited about Olympics, yes. The only thing missing from my trophy room is Olympic medal.
Yeah, they came a bit late for you.
I know. I was a little too old to make a comeback. But that's okay. I can vicariously live through somebody else's.
Absolutely. So when you saw that, is that just another validation? Is that just another moment where you go,
yeah,
we've made it?
Yeah. And funny that you ask that question, because I think about when are those moments when I go, yep, women's surfing has made it. And it wasn't the Olympics. It was actually going down here at my local surf spot at Freshie and seeing the women outnumber the men in the water, seeing the women's, the mothers' surf groups supporting each other, you know, sitting on the beach minding their kids while they tag team going surfing, seeing all of the young girls being encouraged and pushed into waves by their dads and their brothers. Like that to me suggests that there's been a complete shift in acceptance and validation of women in the water.
People don't talk about it anymore. Like
no.
It's just surfing. It's guys and girls. It's like cricket now.
Yes.
You know, it's just like it's on the calendar. It's like, oh, the girls are playing.
Yeah.
The women are playing, whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
Oh, the blokes are playing also. There's an Ashes series and
there's
a World Cup. Is that boys or girls? Like that's what I love about it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. So it's good to see that we've got to that place after such a long period of time.
Who are the people when you're on tour that you absolutely had to beat, or they were the ones that brought the best out in you? Like, you know, there's
all
always
no
there's always that, you know, Federer and Nadal, and now Djokovic coming into that, and now Radulov with Everett Lloyd and so forth. Who were those people for you?
My greatest rival was Lisa Anderson.
Okay.
Yeah, she was the golden girl of women surfing. And I often say, and as you may have seen in the documentary, I feel like I was the little black sheep of the surfing industry.
Yeah.
Because I was this tenacious, focused, go-getting, agitating champion who really wanted more, not just for herself but for the sport in the whole. And I was bookended by these two glamorous, gorgeous, stylish goats called Stephanie Gilmore and Lisa Anderson who were so well supported by the industry, still are, just golden girls. You know, they're just the pin-up girls of what glamour and beauty and style and grace look like. And I didn't feel like I had any of that. I was like, fuck all of that. I just got to go out and win. I got to win. That validated my struggle mentality, because I believed that success had to be hard.
Yeah.
And so I certainly made it so. And so I believed that it wasn't, you know, I wasn't worthy of success unless it was a struggle. And so it was nothing but a struggle. And so whenever I fall back into that struggle mentality, I seek evidence to disprove it and poke holes in it by looking at someone like Steph Gilmore,
who
does everything with a smile on her face. Look, I know there's struggle and there's hard times and it's challenging to be the best in the world and there's a lot that comes with it, but she makes it look so fun. She makes it look so effortless. There's so much beauty, style, grace and ease about it, and I had to learn to trust in that to win my seventh world title. So I know I'm capable of it, but when the person who brought the best out in me was Lisa Anderson, because I absolutely,
passionately disliked losing to her. And she passionately disliked losing to me. I think she still dislikes me.
Yeah, but I was going to ask you, are you mates?
No.
Mutual respect, but
yeah,
not
mutual.
Mates.
Yeah, mutual respect and admiration, and we're amicable. But I would never call her a mate. You know, I love Lisa. I love what Lisa did for women surfing. But we just don't see the world through the same coloured lens. And as you saw in the documentary, you know, 30 years later, she still states that I wouldn't have won as many world titles if she was still on tour.
Yeah.
Well, she may not have won 4 world titles if she didn't fall pregnant and marry the head judge. Like, just things, how they work out. So good luck to you.
Amen.
But seriously, yeah. let it go. I got 7, you got 4. Like, yeah. Steph's got 7, Chris has got 5. You know, like, you know, but what I did love about Lisa is that she constantly set the benchmark, and so she taught me how I needed to do the same. Most kids, and I'm still a kid, we learn from what we see more so than what we hear. And I saw what Lisa was doing, and I thought, okay, I need to do that, but I'm going to do it Lane's way, and I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to do it better because I now see what my role is in all of this. And as the world champion, I've got to keep raising the bar, keep setting the benchmark, keep setting the scale, keep challenging the status quo. You know, that's my role.
Yeah. And I sounds exhausting that. Though.
Yeah, it was. Because I was the women's tour director as well as the world champion, as well as running events, building a clothing brand, having a charity.
A lot going on.
Yeah, it was a shitload. Yeah.
Just quickly interrupting the episode to say a very big thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, and that is Shaw & Partners Financial Services. Shaw & Partners are an Australian investment and wealth management firm who manage over $28 billion of assets under advice. With 7 offices across Australia, Shaw & Partners act for and on behalf of individuals, institutions, corporates and charities. For more info, you can check out their website at shawandpartners.com.au. That's S-H-A-W for Shaw. Shaw & Partners Financial Services, your partners in building and preserving wealth. Now let's get back into the episode.
Well, we're sitting at your beautiful home here looking over Freshie, and, you know, like, I know this type of stuff is not the most important thing, but you've got a beautiful home.
Yeah.
You've got a beautiful husband.
I do.
Your life is
beautiful.
Pretty good.
Yes.
Let's talk about the big fella, because he was in a band that was pretty good.
Yeah, they were not bad.
In Excess went okay.
Boy band. Inkses.
Inkses, they were pretty good.
I think the first concert I ever went to was an NXS concert when I was 14.
Really?
Yeah.
And there he was banging away on the...
Banging away on his guitar and saxophone and singing along. I was like, oh, who is that dork?
How did you meet him? And I have heard this story, but I'd love you to tell our listeners your first date, which didn't exactly go to plan. At least the first part of it didn't go to plan.
No, none of it went to plan. I don't know how we're still sitting here talking about the fact that a rock star and a surf star have collided.
Yeah.
Two worlds collided. So Kirk and I were set up on a blind date by John Stevens. And when I went to the In Excess show, John really wanted me to, you know, have a chat with Kirk and take him on a date. I made this.
So did John think that you two would be great together?
Yes.
Right.
I don't know how he saw that.
Okay.
Well, obviously, Kirk and I love to laugh. We love to have fun. We don't take ourselves too seriously. We can laugh at life and at ourselves. And we both were obviously the best in the world at what we did, and we knew we would understand that and have that basis of respect and recognition of those things. So, yeah, John just thought you two should meet.
Yeah.
I was like, no. I got no interest.
Were you dating anyone at the time? Or?
Oh, look, I was spending a bit of time with another musician who was from America. And, yeah, I'd had...
Someone would know?
Yes, yes. Someone you'd definitely know.
You don't want to tell us who it was?
There was a bit of unrequited love there going on. Chris Isaac.
Okay.
And, yeah, so Chris,
I love Chris Isaac.
I know, we all love Chris Isaac. Yeah.
Silky voice.
Yeah. Good surfer too.
Is he?
Yeah.
Is that how you met?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, we digest.
You just like to get people to expose things on this podcast, don't you?
What?
Expose. Okay.
Yeah. So you're sort of seeing Chris Isaac.
Hanging out with Chris Isaac. Nothing too serious there because he's in San Francisco and I'm in Australia. Anyway, Kirk and I meet at this In Excess show after a private In Excess function, and he's really nervous, apparently. He calls it nerves, but I just thought he was being absolutely rude and disrespectful because
I'd introduce myself to him while he was having a conversation with someone else. He'd like, yeah, hi, nice to meet you, and then go on, continue on with the conversation. I was like, look, I'm politely interrupting you to get your attention, but you're not paying me any attention. So I'm thinking, okay, you've got no interest in this. So then I, towards the end of the night, I'm like, okay, I'm done. I've done my best. I'm out. Go over to John's and say goodnight to him, and Kirk and he are talking. I'm like, oh, shit. And John went, Lane, Kirk, look. And you were like, yeah, we've met. Go to the bar, you two. Go and have a drink. Talk it out.
So he's quite bullish about getting you guys together.
John's very bullish about it. He's very resolute.
Is he now taking full credit for
Absolutely,
this
relationship?
Absolutely,
yes. I love that. Yeah, me too. And so we go to the bar and we have a chat and we start talking about our previous relationships and why they recently ended and what went wrong, all the things you're not meant to talk about when you first start talking to each other. And then we get interrupted by Gary Beers, and then Kirk accuses Gary of grass cutting. So he walks off in a tiff, and I'm left there standing at the bar with Gary going,
what's going on here?
So then I walk past Kirk on my way to the bathroom with the drink he left at the bar and give it to him, go, you over it yet? And keep walking. So, yeah, it doesn't really start off very well.
No, it doesn't.
But then 2 weeks later, I called Kirk a week later. 2 weeks later, we go on a date. I take him 10-pin bowling at DYRSL.
Of course. Where else would you go?
So classy. Then we go to a restaurant in DY Beachfront and, yeah, halfway through dinner, there's no connection. There is no chemistry. Really, neither of us want to be there. We're both there out of obligation to John. And then I go to the bathroom looking for a window to climb out of, thinking, if it's big enough, I'm out of here. While I'm in the bathroom taking an exorbitant amount of time, Kirk's at the table thinking, if I just leave the money and do a runner, do you think she'll care? In the bathroom I'm thinking, do you think Kirk will do a runner? That'd be really good.
That would save me.
But then I realise his car's at my house. We've had a bit of wine. Like maybe he won't be able to drive. Shit, now I'm into trouble. And the owner
not overthinking it at all.
No, not at all. No, I'm planning an exit strategy before the dinner's even over. And the owner of the restaurant, who's a friend of mine, recognised things may have looked a little tenuous, came over with a bottle of limoncello and we finished it.
Aha.
Got things rolling. Like, let the good times roll. And, yeah, we just loosened up and then it became lots of fun. And then Kirk walked me home and I had the hiccups and he just thought that was the most adorable thing ever. And then he decided to stay the night, but I wouldn't allow him to sleep. Well, I let him sleep in my bed, but he had to sleep in his clothes. No sex on the first date.
So you had that squared away.
Yeah, I had that squared away.
Any kissing at all?
Yeah, yeah, we made out because I actually had decided if he's a good kisser, he can stay. So
good thinking.
Yeah, so I let him stay.
Okay.
And but he woke up alone because I'd gone surfing before the sun had come up. He's like, oh, so this is what I'm in for. So he was already thinking that this was going to progress even further.
The limoncello is taking it to another level.
I tell you, he must have woken up drunk still or something. Yeah. And then that night was my brother's wedding, so he helped choose my outfit. He ironed my outfit. He went downstairs. My PA was living with us, Brooke. He chose her outfit. He ironed her outfit.
Oh, wow.
This guy's a keeper. Tick, yeah.
Wow.
Then drove us to my brother's wedding, dropped us off, and then he went off and played at Farm Aid out at Homebush, you know, had the show on.
For INXS.
Yeah, for INXS, after ironing our outfits.
Rock and roll life that he's had.
He's going to be one of the most domesticated rock stars you'll ever meet.
Yeah.
He's very, very clean and tidy and loves cooking, loves cleaning, he's out doing the grocery shopping right now, or maybe he's doing my mailing. I don't know. He's always doing something.
Stuff.
Oh. He's the best.
So when did you fall in love with him? Because it sounds like he's already in love, so that took him like 8 minutes.
Yeah, I know. He falls very easily, this guy. Look, we dated – so that was a Friday night. He went off on Saturday, and then on Sunday we went on our second date, which was to the Gold Class Cinemas at Moore Park to watch Austin Powers. And ended up back at his house, and I'd drunk too much and I couldn't drive home, so I rang Rangy and I went, it's all your fault, you know what's going to happen, and I can't go home, and damn you. And Rangy went, good, enjoy it, bye. And then on Monday I went home, and then he was getting ready to go on tour, and Tuesday, Wednesday we only spoke, we didn't see each other, and then the Friday I was about to head off overseas until Christmas, and so was he. And on Thursday I was packing my board bag, and my PA was asking me, so what do you think about Kirk? Do you miss him? Do you like him? I was like, yeah, I really feel something. Like, I really miss him. I haven't seen him for a few days. She's like, well, why don't you invite him over? And so we were having dinner at my neighbor's house, and I rang my neighbor and said, do you mind if I bring Kirk over? They're like, yeah, please do.
Yeah.
So he came over, and he was really grateful that I'd called because he was missing me too, and he didn't want to, you know, be too suffocating or whatever. Yeah. And so then we parted ways for 2 months, but we talked every day. And so it was that Thursday, I reckon, that I went, I really like this guy. Yeah. I see something in the future with him. And then, yeah, he proposed to me in 2008. So we'd been
together
for 6 years. Okay. And then we got married on the 10th of the 10th, 2010, at 10 a.m.
I remember seeing you at John Singleton's.
Oh my gosh.
Brewery. You just got back from your honeymoon. And I remember you telling me, I won't tell the story on air, but what lovely time you had on a beach.
Oh, it's nothing like having sex on a beach.
And I remember saying that, and Kurt was just there, and he's saying, Lainey, I don't think he needs to know all that. You know? It's like, it's Gus, it's all right.
Yeah,
don't worry about
honest
it.
Lane. Loves telling stories.
Yeah.
No shame. Yeah. So, you're on a private beach for several hours and no one around and no one can fly over the top of you, then why not?
Of course, if given the opportunity.
If given the opportunity, yes.
So how long have you been together for now?
Well, we've been together 19 years and married 11.
Right.
Yeah. And so we were married in 2010, yeah.
In Excess stuff came back again to this new generation. So my generation, 53, obviously loved it, used to see them live if we could, and then eventually, you know, watching them in big arenas.
Yeah.
And then the show came out.
Live Baby Live.
And all my kids all of a sudden are downloading In Excess on their Spotify
and
so forth. And it's like, this is really cool. I said, well, try AC/DC as well. Try Dragon. Like, there's so many good bands that we sort of took for granted. We used to watch in pubs.
Yeah.
What was that like for him getting back into the limelight, I suppose?
Well, because they've been able to reinvent themselves several times. Now, after the tragic loss of Michael in 1997, then they reemerged with Terence Trent D'Arby, who wasn't the ideal fit, and then John Stevens came in and reinvigorated their career until the songwriting component between him and Andrew really wasn't gelling. So then they did that TV show, Rockstar in Excess, and found JD Fortune, which completely reinvigorated them again. They've been able to reinvent themselves so many times. So it was just due process for them. Yeah. They're so adaptable. And as you now found out, well, as your kids are finding out, their music is timeless.
Oh.
And I still love it. And Kirk gets embarrassed that I love it so much. You know, we're walking through Coles and it'll turn on, or walking through Woolies.
And you know the words.
Or when he goes in before, because we do talks together. Because I'm a motivational speaker and he's joined the circuit, but he does Q&A and then he'll perform a couple of songs if you pay the right amount. But he tends to forget the lyrics quite often.
So you know them and he doesn't.
I know them and I've got to remind him, okay, because there's in Never Tear Us Apart. No, in Don't Change, I'm Standing Here on the Ground. There's a part where it goes, Resurrection of Happiness, or it's either Resurrection of Happiness or Something of Bitterness. And he keeps flipping them around. Yeah, I'm like, dude.
But you know what? It doesn't matter because everyone who's listening to him is singing it as well.
Exactly. So it's almost I'm buying into his perfectionism and trying to correct it when I'm like, just enjoy it.
Yeah,
just enjoy the show.
He's done pretty good too.
Yeah.
Is he someone who's pretty relaxed? Is he someone like to be in one of the biggest bands of all time? Like, every time I met him, he's just friendly and kind. He looks you in the eye and says hello.
Yeah.
That hasn't always been the case when we've met big stars.
But it's always been the case with Kirk. He's always made the time for people. So, yeah, he admits that there was times when he, you know, became the egomaniac and got swallowed up in that world. And
how can you not?
Exactly, how can you not? But we received a letter from someone that met him who happened to end up being backstage at a concert in Chicago or something back in 1982 or something like that, or 87 because it was the Kick Tour, and he still recalls how friendly and engaging and kind Kirk was. Like, that was the one thing that really resonated with him. Like, all the band came in and they're like, hey, how you going? But Kirk was the only one that walked up to him, introduced himself to him, asked him what he does and what he's doing here, and like really makes the time for people.
Yeah.
So that's one of the other strong connections that we have with each other. Because at the time, Kirk and I had nothing in common. And now he's brought out his own rosé called KP Wine. I'll have to show it to you.
Yeah.
And on the back.
Show it to me. You can pour me a glass.
I'll pour you a glass. I'll share it with you.
Yeah.
kpwine.com.au for anyone that wants to go and buy some.
Yeah.
And he, on the back of that bottle, it tells the story about how it was rosé that helped us find another commonality. Because fortunately, because we've come from such opposing worlds and those two worlds have collided, we're finding that we have more and more in common as we get older, as opposed to finding our direct companion, you know, our immediate reflection and growing apart. We continue to grow together even more, as especially COVID's even brought us closer together. So I'm really grateful that
Yeah.
We were able to trust in that relationship because he was on tour, I was on tour, and we spent the first 5 years pretty much on tour and then colliding.
A lot of trust in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. On opposing sides of the world.
You with those eyes.
Yeah, blue eyes.
So I remember when people first spoke about you guys going out and, of course, you know, you hear it in magazines and stuff. How do you handle that? And how did he handle that?
So Kirk's used to the paparazzi. I certainly was not. He'd been married to Denny Hines, so he was used to, and it was at the height of his career, and Denny was probably the biggest point of her career as well. Mm. So he was familiar with that world. I was not. So I remember the first time we went down to Bondi, we went to Ravisi's for lunch, and there was a pap photographer having lunch who had then called another pap photographer to tell them that we were there, who hid across the street in the bookshop and then started following us down the street. And we ended up getting followed for years. But I learnt that the only reason that they're following you is to get a photo. Mm. So I learnt that if I just stop and turn around and smile, they get the shot and then they piss off. So I'm like, okay, so that's what I do.
It's exactly Jacko's thing.
Yeah.
He looks over and he goes, can you give me half an hour with nothing because I just want to play with my kid?
Yeah.
And then I'll walk over and give you exactly the shot you want.
Yeah.
And they get that.
Yeah.
They go, thank you.
Yeah. So just give them what they want.
Great minds.
And yeah, if they respect that and they respect your space, which it's in their best interest to do so,
yeah,
then it works out just fine. So they've stopped following us now. Obviously, we're old news. We're fish and chip paper. But at the time, it was quite confronting. And
yeah, he had 20 years of it.
Yeah, it was quite strange.
Yeah. But does he play music at home?
No, unless he's really, really drunk. No. Yeah. He picked up the sax once recently. I was like, what is going on? What have you been drinking?
Is that the hardest instrument to play?
Yeah, it's pretty challenging.
My brother tried it when we were at school together, yeah, and he lasted about a month, and he could never get more than...
That's like playing the didgeridoo.
I think Kenny G was the first one that he just fell in love with.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, sax was a huge part of a lot of big bands through the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, and Kirk just picked it up to pick up chicks, you know, and to offer a bit of a different sound.
Well, that worked. It did. Let's get back to you for a moment. Hall of Fame stuff, all the stuff you're doing now because of the person that you were as a surfer.
Mm.
How busy are you and how important is that sort of stuff to you as you go into, you know, the reflection of your life and what you can do now?
Mm. So after my career ended, and look, it ended on my own terms. I'm very fortunate that I chose to retire when I retired, and the decision was a very simple one. Either I do the work out of the water to generate the results I expect in the water, or I don't. And if I don't, get out. So I got out. My passion was waning for surfing. I still love surfing. I'm more in love with surfing today than I've ever been. Yeah. I surf for the love of it. I don't have the expectations to compete against the guys and beat the guys and be better today than I was yesterday. Like, if I go out there and do one turn that stokes me out, I'm like, yes, I've still got it.
You know? Do the guys down there at Freshy, is that where you normally surf? Yeah. Do they respect you?
They do. Yeah, okay,
so there's a little bit of love. Freshwater's a nice, in inverted commas, place.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. I mean, look, and I've become a bit of a law enforcement officer out there. If there are people doing the wrong thing, I'm going to let them know.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you get, with the more world championships, do you get more authority?
No, not at all. No. You've still got to be a good surfer. Yeah. Apparently I'm still good enough to warrant the authority.
Have you ever swum into a break and had people give you shit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it happens at Narrabeen all the time. I was out there a couple of weeks ago and got dropped in on by the same guy three times. And I pulled him up on it each time. And the first time he's like, oh, I thought you were one of the Groms. I'm like, what difference does it make? I'm still behind you. I'm still on the critical part of the wave. I still have right of way. So, hey, how about you give me some respect? Second time, oh, I just didn't see you. Third time, okay, dude, this is unacceptable now. But, hey, I don't care. It's your choice. Stay out here and get dropped in and I'll go in.
Yeah.
Oh. Wonder if I could.
Does he know who you are?
Yeah, of course he knew who I was. Didn't care. So I wonder if I could take that kind of law enforcement and bring it back to Freshy.
Yeah, I doubt it. Narrabeen's a bit rough around the edges, isn't it?
But yes, I still encounter that from time to time. Not very often. And look, I find it quite entertaining. I don't take it very personally because it says more about the person than about me. It's my response to it is what it says about me.
Yeah.
But you know how they behave, it doesn't say anything about me.
I've never been a surfer, but people who
that astounds me
surfing just love it. Like they just cannot imagine starting their day any other way.
Yeah.
And when I'm walking in the mornings, you just see guys pulling it. Look at the car park.
Yeah.
They're taking someone else. Yep, the car park's full.
Yep.
I'm getting in here. And they're always friendly, putting on their wetsuits in winter and stuff. What's that community like?
There's a classic old saying that says, only a surfer knows the feeling. that's the strength and the bond of the community. We speak our own vernacular. We have our own levels of unspoken etiquette and understanding. The mutual connection, the bond, the love is all about the love of the ocean. And it doesn't matter how you enjoy the ocean, whether it's on a boogie board, whether you're body surfing, whether you're on a stand-up paddleboard or a surfboard, it's actually about just going and immersing yourself in a force that's way more powerful than you are.
That's cool. That's a great answer. I love that answer. Thank you. Lainey, we could talk all day.
But which we have already.
So let's get to this fast five, which is the last five questions, ooh, which you should be able to relax into. Mm. Have you got a favourite holiday destination? And are you the type of person that goes on holidays and has to do stuff? Or are you a lob around the pool or at the beach type person?
I'm not a fly and flop person, but in saying that, I don't mind flying and flopping because you asked me a question about all the stuff that I'm doing now and how hard I'm working. And the thing is that I've found a really nice balance. When I saw you up at Singo's brewery launch, I was in a really agitated state where I was non-committing to everything, but by saying yes to everyone and everything, I was looking for that next thing that was going to light me up, that was going to be my passion, my focus, my direction, my purpose. Mm. And what I was doing by constantly seeking it outside of myself was I was robbing of my intrinsic purpose, and that was to serve people. And I just hadn't sat long enough to decide how I wanted to serve people. So I just kept saying yes to everyone and everything. And by doing that, I was actually robbing myself. I was saying no to me. I was saying no to Kirk. I was saying no to my friends and family. I was saying no to surfing because I was saying, yes, I can speak to you. And yes, I can deliver that. And yeah, yeah, yeah. And I ended up with pneumonia and adrenal fatigue.
Yeah.
And I didn't learn. I've learned now.
Yeah.
So today I feel like I found a really healthy balance in the way I live my life, and I had to find a decision-making framework that was best going to serve how I do what I do, which essentially is – and I had to go and find a mentor to help me find this framework, because anyone who's transitioning out of a career that they've identified with and defined themselves by for their whole life, which I had for 20 years – I'd lost, and you know, I talk about that identity piece. I'd lost my sense of identity, and I really hadn't given myself a time to self-define. I'd allowed all the external circumstances around me to define me. And as Ben Crowe beautifully says, it's the decisions, not the conditions, that determine the quality of your life. And I was waiting for all the conditions to be in alignment before I decided that I was going to be good enough or smart enough or talented enough. That's that enoughness discussion.
Yeah.
So today, my decision-making framework, it's either a hell yeah or a fuck no, and there's nothing in between.
I love that.
So hell yeah is if it lights me up, fills me full of curiosity and energy and like, oh yeah, I can. That sounds really good. Before the monkey mind gets involved to try and say, look, you're not smart enough, you don't have the time, you're not talented enough, this may not work out, you could fail. Screw all that. It lit me up first. It's a hell yeah. In the same event, if something very similar comes across my plate, I'm depleted, I'm exhausted, I'm worn out, or I've got a lot of work on, or it comes from a place where I should or I could or I would, it's a fuck no. And there's nothing in between. So in the unlikely event that something comes to me and it's not a hell yeah or a fuck no, then I make it a hell yeah and I commit to it wholeheartedly because it hasn't completely been drowned out by nah. So when you text me, it was always a hell yeah. Because I know you're serving people, and by having these conversations, we're helping and serving people.
Mm.
But if someone's just getting, you know, reaching out to me, like the amount of times I get reached out to saying, here's a great product, do two posts and two stories, fuck no. Like it doesn't interest me.
I love it.
I'm all about meaningful support, meaningful connection and meaningful engagement.
I've just written down hell yeah or fuck no. That is my new motto. Well, that's the favourite quote. So yeah, answered, when I asked you your favourite holiday destination, you gave me a favourite quote.
Yeah.
So let's go. So that one's done. Favourite quote's done.
Okay.
Favourite holiday destination
would be Fiji and Hawaii.
Oh.
They're the two most favourite. And Cottage Point.
Perfect. What about a favourite book?
My favourite book.
Are you a reader?
I am a big reader, but I'm a majority of self-help reading. I love that kind of stuff. My favourite book of all time is Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, what's that about?
It's an Ayn Rand magnus opus that's you just have to read it.
Yeah, I'll have to get a copy of that, okay.
Hang on. My favourite book as a child that I still love is The Never-Ending Story.
Oh, yeah.
I love that book.
I like the Hungry Caterpillar.
Yeah.
So cute.
You can relate to that.
Yeah, I guess. Totally. Favourite movie.
Can I call you Heimlich?
Of course you can.
I could turn you into a beautiful butterfly.
Thank you. Favourite movie?
Can I have two?
Yes.
I have two of everything.
Oh, you can have two of everything. You've won seven world championships. You can have, do whatever you want.
Can I have seven?
Yeah, of course you can. Give us your best movie list.
I'll give you my favourite two movies, which is Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, me too.
And Austin Powers, number two.
Oh, so not the first one.
Not the first one.
With Kirk, but the second one. Okay. Yeah.
Well, it was the second one that I saw with Kirk.
Oh.
First one had already come out.
Yeah, well, that's good. You knew you had the same sense of humour.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, I know that you're aligned with so many charities, but we do have $10,000 to give to multiple charities or your number one or split, however you like.
Yes.
Who would you like the $10,000 from Shawn Partners to go to?
This is so hard because there's so many deserving, wonderful charities out there.
Do you want to take a moment and then let me know later?
Do you mind?
Not at all.
I definitely am going to give some money back to Gotcha for Life because I love what you're doing.
Thank you.
And I've got you for life and I know you've got me for life.
You got it.
So let's keep...
Okay.
Keep that program alive.
We'll do that. And then we'll, another one we can split it with.
Yeah, I want to. I actually might split it between three. I'm also an ambassador for WWF.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Perfect. So I'd love to give some money to WWF.
We'll give them 3333 repeater.
Okay.
And then another one.
And then the other one is a mental health charity because I'm a champion of mental wellness.
Yeah.
And I'd love to give some money to our local charity of Lifeline Northern Beaches.
Perfect. I've been in there many nights and they deserve everything.
They need all the help they can get.
Great. So WWF, Gotcha for Life and Lifeline Northern Beaches.
Yes.
That sounds pretty good to me.
Beauty. We've got the environment, we've got mental wellness and we've got...
Mental fitness.
Mental fitness.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure, mate.
You too, Gus.
Well, that was Lane Beachley, and isn't she just incredible? I just love her so much, and I love that attitude, that competitive attitude, and also if it's not a fuck yes, it's a hell no. I just want to live my life that way as well. Coming up next episode on Not an Overnight Success is one of Australia's most respected and well-known businessmen, Mark Burris. Mark has that keep your head down and focus on your own game kind of attitude that I love, and it served him well and brought him from quite humble beginnings to where he is now. A big thank you to Shaw and Partners Financial Services who have generously supported this podcast and also donated $10,000 to the charity of choice of each of our guests to thank them for their time. Shaw and Partners are an Australian investment and wealth management firm who manage over $28 billion of assets under advice. With seven offices around Australia, Shaw and Partners act for and on behalf of individuals, institutions, corporates and charities. For more info, you can check out their website at shawandpartners.com.au. That's S-H-A-W for Shaw. Shaw and Partners Financial Services, your partners in building and preserving wealth.